Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppins.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And today we are going to talk about fairy tales, because Kathleen has just finished rewriting The Ballad of Tamlin in a new rendition, and it is all about encounters of human beings with the fairies, specifically in this case, the Fairy Queen, and it has some really interesting themes in there, and it's also set in a place not too far from where we are recording, which is in Scotland. And the setting is actually a lovely place in the Scottish borders. You were the one who pushed me onto this idea that very close by from where we had a home, there was actually a very magical place, a land of the fairies, where something magical happened. How did you come across the legend or the Ballad of Tamlin?
I've been in love with this legend of Tamlin for more than half of my life. And a lot of Americans out there who are in my age group might remember this. There was a fantastic series made by the Time Life Corporation that came out in the early 80s called The Enchanted World. And it was one of those book club things where you subscribe to the book club and once a month you get a new edition for this club, and you create this sort of library of a particular theme. And the Enchanted World books are absolutely gorgeous. And it was an amazing collection of mythology and folklore from around the world. And so I found this Time Life series, which my parents gave me as a gift. And I get this Fairies and Elves book. And in addition to being fantastic stories, the illustrations in these books are absolutely stunning. So it was such a sort of treat for the senses to every month when one of these books arrived, because you'd be sort of immersed in this world of magic. And I remember seeing this one story called Tamlin. Now, the funny thing is, I was looking at the pictures, and the pictures were clearly Celtic. I mean, there are people wearing tartans in this, and it's very beautiful. But Tamlin was such a weird name for me. I actually thought it was Asian. I thought, is this an Asian story? But why are they wearing tartans? And it wasn't until later, when I did more investigation into the story, that I understood that Tamlin is sort of an adaptation of a number of different names. He's been Thomas Lynn or Thomas Lyne. He's been Tamerlane. There's a number of different names that this enchanted knight has been known by. So Tamlin becomes the name of the knight. So I read this story and I was absolutely beside myself when I read it, because it is a fairy tale in reverse. In this story, it is the girl who has to rescue the boy. And so that really struck me, because it was certainly unusual in fairy tales. So I thought it was really wonderful and interesting. And the other thing was that there were two really strong female characters in this legend. And one was Janet, who is the girl who is going to rescue the boy. But the other is the Fairy Queen. And the Fairy Queen is the villain in this book, in this story. Apparently, ostensibly, she is the villain. Because the legend is that this knight, Tamlin, was once a human. He was abducted by the Fairy Queen when he fell off his horse one day. She took him to the land of fairies, and where he has served her for 7 years. And now he is going to be sacrificed to the powers of hell, because the Fairy Queen every 7 years has to pay a tithe or a fine to hell, and it's going to be the sacrifice of this knight, who Janet ultimately falls in love with through a series of interesting events. And the only person who can save this knight from being sacrificed by the Fairy Queen is Janet. So we had these two female characters that were in opposition. There was this power struggle. There felt like a lot of sort of goddessy stuff going on in the story to me. And I really loved it. And then what happened was, a year or two later, a friend of mine, completely separately, introduced me to this Ballad of Tamlin as it had been recorded in music. We hadn't been talking about this. I hadn't told her that I had this love of this tale. She just came over one day and said, "Have you ever heard this?" And it was vinyl. She brought a record over that day and said, "Have you ever heard this song by Fairport Convention, a kind of a folk band from England in the 70s. Amazing singer named Sandy Denny, who passed away quite young. incredible voice. And what they had done is they had taken a version of the ballad from the 16th century and recorded it. And it's absolutely fabulous. And I wish we could play it for you today, but there are copyright issues. So I would say go to YouTube and put in Ballad of Tamlin, Fairport Convention, and have a listen to the ballad. And when I heard the ballad, I was done. I was hooked. The ballad just pulled me into it. There was something about hearing this woman vocalize this story that just really grabbed me in terms of how ancient it was. So I've been in love with this story for many, many years, and I always said someday I'm going to sit down and write about this story. I'm going to do a version of it. I never really knew how it was going to manifest. Maybe it was going to be, in a collection. I've kind of toyed with the idea of writing a collection about women in Celtic mythology, some kind of an anthology. I wasn't entirely sure how it was going to manifest until a couple of things happened in my life that changed it, like you.
Indeed. And one of the things was obviously that you came to this part of Scotland, and it was the part where the story has happened. And I think an awful lot of people think that fairy tales or fiction as a whole sometimes is completely invented. And where we are, North Berwick, is a place where Robert Louis Stevenson would come on his summer holidays. And as a small boy, he looked towards some of the islands in front of the coast and fell in love with some of the things he saw, and made them into things like Treasure Island. So you can always trace back certain things to certain real life events, even though you think that the setting itself is completely made up or fabricated. Now, the interesting thing is that the fairy tale, the Ballad of Tamlin, always has had a very strong setting. People have always known where it was set, at least the core part of it, the Coulterhall Forest, the place where these encounters happen, the well where it happened. That is very precisely defined. And some of the other aspects as to the bridge, or like where she lived, some people have gone to a very large setting several miles apart, others have stuck to a closer setting. But it's something which has been very clearly again defined in places. And that is something I think which makes it quite special and makes it definitely for me, and I think for you as well, when we went to investigate it, really come to life. Like, these are the places of the ballad where this thing happened.
Well, I think what happens is that we get to this place of saying, okay, it's fairy tale. It's made up. It's invented. And so we don't tend to think of it in terms of real people having a real experience. But what's fascinating about this particular part of Scotland, and this region known as the Borders, is how alive the stories are. The Borders are a place where the veil is thin, where the fairies and the humans interact. And when you go there, you really feel that. I mean, even today in the 21st century, you can't go anywhere in the Borders without stumbling over something named after Thomas the Rhymer, for example. The Thomas the Rhymer story is probably the most famous of the fairy stories from this region. Thomas the Rhymer basically follows the fairy queen into the fairy world and becomes her consort, in a wonderful, wonderful story. And which I when I decided that I was going to write the Ballad of Tamlin, again, thinking originally that this was strictly a fairy tale, I hadn't really gone into this idea of what was the historical context until I started to work on it. Kind of backing up for a minute, back in the early to mid 90s, at the kind of the beginning of the internet, when we were all first sort of exploring, like, what is this internet thing all about, and how does this make us global citizens? I remember that I started corresponding with a woman in Scotland who lived near the borders, and I asked her if this place, Carter Haugh, was a real place. The opening verse of Tamlin says, "I forbid ye maidens all who wear gold in your hair to travel to Carter Haugh, for young Tamlin is there." So it's a cautionary tale. Girls, don't go to Carter Haugh because this knight is there. And by the way, if you go to Carter Haugh and you do something that you are not supposed to do, this knight is going to extract a fee from you. So one of the things is that these fairy people are actually guardians of the earth. This in this case, Tamlin is a guardian of Carter Haugh Forest. So we know from the ballad that Carter Haugh is a place, but also that it's a sacred place because the fairy guardian would not be there protecting this sacred well and the roses which grow around it unless it mattered. These aren't just any roses. This isn't just any well. Tamlin is there to protect the roses. And if you cut a rose without his permission, then you have to pay a fine. And that fine can be a golden ring. It can be your mantle. Or if you were really a transgressor, the fine is your maidenhead. In other words, Tamlin takes your virginity for your transgression at the well. So this now brought this to a place of this is a real ancient initiation story, right? But you've got these places that are described in the ballad. The Carterhaugh Forest. Carterhaugh comes up over and over again. There's a place at Halloween where Janet has to do battle with the Fairy Queen. It has to happen at Miles Cross. So back in the 90s, I was corresponding with this woman named Sheila, who I've lost touch with. And if she ever hears this, I hope she'll get back in touch with me because she was amazing and helpful and knew a lot. And she then sent me the information about where Carterhaugh was in the borders. And I was very excited. And I thought, okay, I'm going to someday when I get there, I'm going to go take a look. And over the years, I came to Scotland and I never did get there because I was off doing other things. I was investigating Arthur in Scotland and other aspects, things in the Isle of Skye. And I just never got around to it until I met Philip. And then here I was sort of thrust in the middle of this place, so close to it. That we just had to start looking. And what astonished me was how realistic these locations are, and also that they have been well marked and well preserved by the local people. Tamlin's well, there's a whole thing in the ballad that happens around the well and because of the well. Tamlin's well is actually well marked. There is a plaque there, embedded in cement at the side of the road that says this is the place of Tamlin's well. It says Tamlane's well. Now, this is all very close to the property of Sir Walter Scott, where he lived, because he was obsessed with these borders and it is these border legends. And it is through a lot of his work that we have the border ballads. He wrote a very important collection of the ballads that happened and evolved from that part of Scotland. So we started investigating these locations, and all of a sudden, this story became very much alive for both of us. As you start climbing through this forest and driving around it and using survey maps and trying to figure out where could this have happened and where is this bridge, and all of a sudden, you start seeing how the locations come together. There is a bridge. There is a place that is within a mile, and it is a crossroads, and it is a Miles Cross, and all of a sudden, you're hit with this whole idea of, oh my gosh, this is based on real people and real events. And so that rocked my world in the best way, because now I wanted to really understand like what time frame could this have happened in and you know, where did it come from? And what ultimately I think is so magical about Tamlin is on one hand, you have this ancient story and you can go back to stories in ancient Greece and beyond that have a similar theme. So you know that the actual idea of this initiation and these awakenings that are happening are as old as humanity itself. And yet the story, the way it takes place, the way it unravels, the locations where it occurs, and certainly the characters are very specifically of Scotland. This is a Celtic tale at its most excellent, but it's also a very specifically Scottish legend, and therefore I wove it into Scottish history. I anchored it very firmly in Scottish history, and my absolute belief is that something like this did happen shortly after the death of William Wallace, and therefore this ballad takes place in the early 1300s in my retelling of the story.
Well, I mean, when we look at maps, and this is how we found things like Tamlin's well, they're actually indicated on the Ordnance Surveys map, and it's remarkable, I think, how much of the fairy mythology is still visible on these maps. Wherever you turn, there is the fairy glen, there is the little lake of the fairies. All of these places across Scotland have been mapped to this very day, and we'll probably come back to that at a later moment in time. And when you say that it's a universal theme, I think it goes back to very ancient times, that the fairies, this other world, this access to the other world is something which happens across the world. But each country has dealt with it differently. And I think one of the things which I see in Scotland, and specifically the borders, but also the very extreme northwest of Scotland, is that these traditions lived on extremely long. There are accounts from the 17th century where the people in northwestern Scotland were still sacrificing bulls, and the local priests basically had to go along with them. The borders on a map appear to be something kind of like, a small region between England and Scotland, but when you fly over them in a plane, it is nothingness for 5 to 10 minutes. It's never really come into the 21st century, and I can only imagine how it was back then in the 14th century. And so, for anything to be of an otherworldly dimension, really was left untouched, whereas the fairies might have long disappeared from most parts of England because they had been urbanized for centuries, if not millennia, by then. In the borders, it was largely untouched, and what is happening there in the 14th century is really what I would call the end of mythical Scotland for that region, in the sense that all of a sudden, the borders become the setting for bloodshed, for wars between Scotland and England, for fighting, and it loses its magic, and that is also some of the backdrop, and some of the players, in that saga are the ones you put forth, and it is actually interesting when you start talking. We'll come back to it later as well, but I just want to touch upon it, which is that when you identified some of the players, you touch upon Roxburgh, which is a city nearby, and there fighting is going on, but this bloodshed immediately gets linked to the fairies as well, and like the protection which some people might have to the fairies, and how upset the fairies might be about some of the things which are happening there. So, shortly after William Wallace, i.e., Braveheart, all of these things are happening. There are clues in the ballads which allow for certain identifications of what's going on. So, what kind of identifications were you able to do, and how far could you push it?
Well, the true key to the whole story really was the Fairy Queen. And what happened was when we started climbing around the borders, and for all of you out there who want to come to Scotland or who are interested in traveling to Scotland on holiday, I have to say, very few people put the borders high on their list because they want to go to the islands, they want to go to the Highlands, they want to go to Edinburgh, all of which are incredibly amazing places. But if you have a lot of time, the borders is so magical for all of the reasons that you just said. And because they have these incredible layers of history and folklore, and because those layers have not been entirely eroded. And I think it's one of the few places left where the stories are so close to the surface still. So for me, what happened was when we started digging through all the border legends, Thomas the Rhymer kept coming back and coming back and coming back. He really is sort of the demigod of the borders, this whole Rhymer story. And when you go out into the fields, all of a sudden there'll be this beautiful plaque that's been put there by a Scottish Historical Association saying, "This is where Thomas the Rhymer encountered the Fairy Queen." Like you said, these fairy locations and encounters are actually on government survey maps. I actually found Tamlyn's Well and the story around it on a government website for Scotland. So, these things are really well recorded. But what happened was there's a fairy queen who is omnipotent in both of these legends, in the legend of Thomas the Rhymer and the legend of Tamlyn. This fairy queen is all powerful, but what's fascinating about her is in the ballad of Thomas the Rhymer, she is the essence of beauty. She is the embodiment of beauty. She is the guardian of the world. And one of the things that is critical in that legend, which also brought me to the historical piece, back to your question, is that she shows Thomas She takes him to the underworld and shows Thomas how the world is suffering because of the wars that are happening above them. They are on the way to Fairyland, and they have to go through 40 days of through a river of blood. And he says, "What is this terrible place?" And she says, "This is where the blood from the wars that you are fighting above us is seeping into the land. This is, it has to go somewhere. When that blood is shed, it comes into the land, and this is what it does." And she shows him the sorrows. And so through the things that the Fairy Queen says to Thomas the Rhymer, and because Thomas the Rhymer is a legitimate character, Thomas of Earlston, he is a documented human historical character who actually was involved with William Wallace, that became my starting point. It was like, okay, if we know that the Rhymer was alive, and we know, by the way, he was a famous prophet, because he comes back from the Fairy Kingdom. The Fairy Queen sends him back to go help William Wallace, actually, and gives him this gift of prophecy. He becomes known as True Thomas because he cannot speak a lie, but he also has this ability to sort of prophesize the future, and he's able to advise Wallace and as a result helps Wallace to have his victory at Stirling Bridge and some other things. So that was where I was able to start. Now, what was fascinating is this sort of amazing mother goddess character, by the time you get to Tamlin, has completely shifted. When you look at Tamlin, now she is malevolent. She is all things dark. So my first thought was, okay, we have a dark queen, we have a light queen. I see there's something going on here that is really ancient, really primordial. The dark side of the goddess, the bright side of the goddess. You know, there's lessons here about initiation. But as I dug further, I realized that there was even more going on there, that it was even deeper than that. And I'm not going to go into it because I don't want to spoil it for anyone who is going to read the book. I will say that it's currently available as an ebook, by the way, The Ballad of Tamlin. It is on Amazon and it is on iTunes. It will eventually be on Nook for Barnes & Noble, but they're slow. I don't know why. But hang in there. It's coming. So what I've done is I've written the fictional piece as a novella. It's shorter than a novel, much longer than a short story, however. I've written The Ballad of Tamlin from the point of view that I ultimately discovered it, incorporating The Ballad of the Rhymer as well. But then the second half of the book is all of the nonfiction. It's where I show you how we found this information, how we came across the historical piece, how I made these associations and all of that. So I think it's really a unique I think it's a unique approach to storytelling, but I was so excited by the fact that we've got this beautiful, rich balladry and legend, but we've also got some really amazing sort of non-fictional themes to talk about. So it falls under the category of a new series that I've created called Legends of the Divine Feminine. And this is book one of Legends of the Divine Feminine, because what I really have fallen in love with and have discovered in this process is that all fairy tales contain such amazing wisdom within them. I think it was Albert Einstein said, and I'm paraphrasing him, but he said, if you want your children to be wise or to grow to be wise, read them fairy tales. And now I certainly understand what that's about, because there is so much wisdom hidden in these ancient stories. There's so much for us to learn from. So this idea that there is a combination of oral tradition and wisdom tradition being kept in these legends, as well as the history, I thought was extraordinary.
Absolutely. And as you say, Thomas de Rhymer is somebody whose presence is definitely felt across the borders. And I think the few people who really come to the borders come to see that kind of era. And it's not so much the fact that Earlston, from where he was, you know, is the magical place to visit, but definitely the Aiden Hills are magical mountains. They feature in my book, Land of the Gods. They feature in everything Sir Walter Scott's write, because he is obsessed with them. And they are magical mountains in the sense that there are legends to do with King Arthur. It is said that they were hollow, that King Arthur was buried underneath. There are standing stones nearby. That it is a magical landscape, and to some extent, I think what also happened with the legends of Thomas de Rhymer is that they were anchoring those ancient sites, those ancient important sites, with his story. and that he sort of relived what everybody else before them had relived as well, and that these encounters with the other world, which had been happening there for thousands of years, and were now preserved. They were written down through Thomas de Rymer, and then Sir Walter Scott kind of steps into his shoes. And it's always said that, well, it's always said, there are some people who say that Sir Walter Scott believed that he was the reincarnation of Thomas de Rymer, and that he basically had to adapt the legends of that period and make them once again available and preserved for another generation of people. And I think that is, you know, a very important aspect. And you also were talking about the second sight, which Thomas had and had acquired. And that is also something which you see an awful lot in Scotland. And again, in the northwestern parts, we were recently at Iona, and one of the books on the ferry actually was about second sight and how people in the Highlands are very convinced that people had second sight up to recent times. So with that, you really see how all of these legends live and are happening in this place. And again, it's etched on the landscape. And just as a kind of an aside, we went to Iona, and the gods decided that we should leave it about an hour earlier than we were planning on doing by sending this tremendous rainstorm to us, which meant we jumped on the ferry into the car. And as soon as we were in the car, kind of like, you know, 10 minutes away and less than a mile away from where it was just raining, all of a sudden the weather changed. And we'll come back to that when we were starting to investigate Carter Hall as well, because there were very interesting weather phenomena happening there as well. Anyway, we were on the ferry, and because it was raining, we were inside, and as you do, you rush to the nearest place of cover, and the only seats available were next to a map of Iona and the nearby island of Mull. And I just began to look at that map and realized that throughout what we were seeing was the way back, our drive back, was going to take us to a place where on the map it had been carefully mapped as a place of the ferry, a hill of the ferry, a lake of the ferry, and that there were also ancient standing stones nearby. Just before, we were looking at legends of how St. Columba had come to Iona, and how there is a hill on Iona, or rather a little mount, where it's said that he encountered angels. And when you start looking in some of the renditions, you see that these angels are actually a rendition of fairies, that the Christians, obviously, you know, there are no such thing as fairies. So what do we do with them? Oh, well, let's make them angels. And I was actually beginning to think, you know, how many of the versions of Christianity where we are looking at angels, specifically when it comes to Ireland, specifically when it comes to Celtic countries, but maybe even further afield, really are all to do with these otherworldly beings, which they couldn't identify or keep as such because they were pagan things, so they had to Christianize them, and so they became angels. Anyway, on Iona, a hill of the angels, known for generations, which then St. Columba basically comes to, and basically it's the first thing he has to do to take possession of this island. And so in a very small corner of Scotland, you see numerous references to fairies. And then when I was trying to find out more about the place on Mull with the fairies, all of a sudden you're beginning to see that Scotland really is full of fairy locations. Skye, the fairy glen, is a well-known one, but there are just so many. There's a Glen Shee near Aberdeen, and when you start looking at maps and specifically start detailing, you know, looking at ordnance surveys maps, very detailed maps of areas, they are, I would say, not everywhere, because that's overstating it, but they are in so many places. Pretty much every sacred place in Scotland has still got this connotation of the fairies. And it's an extraordinary, interesting aspect that all of this has been preserved. And again, it's due to the fact that Scotland pretty much to this day maintains this link, because What we found out in our research was that the legends of Thomas the Rhymer are still enacted in places like Melrose, which sits at the foot of the Aiden Hills.
Well, first of all, the word "she" is always your clue when you're looking. If you're traversing any of the Celtic countries, and you see Knocknashee, Glennashee, Lochnashee, anything that has the word "she" in it, she means fairy. And for those of you who might be sort of new to this idea of Celtic fairies, let me say that we're not talking about little creatures with wings that fly around. That's not the way that Celtic fairy tales are perceived in the Celtic cultures. There are certainly those little creatures. You have the leprechauns and you have the little fairies, which in Ireland are called the Sibhe, the yellow fairies. But the she, when the primary Celtic she reference refers to magical beings who are human looking. They look like us. When you have a vision of the she, you're actually seeing people who look like people, but there's something a little more magical about them. They have what is known as a fairy glamour. There's always something a little bit more beautiful, glittering to them than there is with normal people. So when you see fairy encounters in these tales, the fairy queen is a normal looking woman, except that she is supernaturally beautiful. So again, we're not talking about these little tiny fairies. We're talking about another being who looks very, very human, but has these other sort of supernatural qualities. What I want to go back to is the Christianizing of these ballads for a minute, because one of the reasons it took me 20 plus years to write about Tamlin is I was put off of it for a while because this whole concept of at the end of 7 years, the fairy queen pays a tithe to hell, bothered me. As a Celt and as someone who had been immersed in the study of Celtic fairy lore for many, many years, and I really did have studied this in all over the Celtic nations for most of my life since I was 17. So this is a true passion for me and something that I would say that I'm an expert in. I couldn't reconcile this idea of a fairy queen and hell. They didn't go together. Fairies don't believe in hell. Fairies don't have any sort of concept of this Christianized world. So it became clear to me that this piece of Tamlin had definitely been Christianized. And if you look into the history of Scotland, there was a very terrible period here. From the end of the 16th through much of the 17th century, of burning times. There were a lot of people burned as witches here, and I'm writing another book about that that will be out, another ebook that will be out early next year called The North Berwick Witches, about some of the more famous cases here. And there are cases of women who actually went to the stake and were burned to death because they befriended the fairy queen. So this idea of the fairy kingdom was no joke in Scotland. I mean, people believed in it with all their hearts, and lost their lives for it in a number of cases. And it's really not so crazy when you're immersed in it. You certainly ha there. I've had some amazing experiences in Ireland and in Scotland, which are entirely unexplainable. I write about them a little bit in the afterword of The Ballad of Tamlin in the book. Don't be too quick to judge people who say that they've had fairy encounters, because there are thousands and thousands of firsthand testimonials of these kinds of experiences. But ultimately, what I realized was this idea of the fairy queen paying a tithe to hell was a Christianization, something that was tacked on much, 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 much later, and probably didn't exist. However, and again, I don't want to give away too much, but I think that this idea, like you were saying with the angels in Iona, it had to become the Hill of the Angels because it couldn't be the Hill of the Fairies. You can't have an experience with fairies if you're a monk on Iona. So if you see something that is beautiful and unexplainable that helps you, it has to be an angel. Now, it could be an angel, but you're having this experience in a place where for thousands of years there has been an otherworldly connection, a fairy connection. And so ultimately, for me, what I think with this paying a tithe to hell was about the fact that at the end of 7 years, Tamlin was no longer going to be able to return to the human world. We see this over and over again in the fairy stories. If you go into the fairy kingdom and you stay for a day over 7 years, you can never come back. And this happens with Thomas the Rhymer. He has to leave at his seventh year if he's going to come back to the human world. And this happens with Tamlin at the end of, he's been there for 7 years and now he's going to be sacrificed to hell. And I think that that might have evolved from this idea that at the end of 7 years, you cannot leave the fairy kingdom. You're going to be in the underworld. So I think you've got that hell is the underworld kind of thing. And I think you also have that sort of Christianized idea that, that if anything that is not Christian is hell or demonic or otherworldly related. One of the questions that Janet asks Tamlin in one version of the ballad, and by the way, there are many versions of the ballad because it does evolve from, it first appears in writing in 1549, and then we see it all the way through the Walter Scott stuff, and then of course it comes back and is sort of rewritten and retold for balladry in the 60s and 70s of the 20th century. But one of the things that Janet asks Tamlin in a later version of the ballad is, you know, do you know who died upon the cross? Were you ever in a church? So there is this one ballad verse that's very, very Christianized, because if she's trying to determine whether or not Tamlin has ever actually been human or if he is strictly an elf who is trying to fool her. And so the idea is if he knows this information about Christianity, if he can answer these questions, then he's telling her the truth and he is in fact human. So we do see where this all becomes sort of quite Christianized, and you can certainly see where St. Columba would have had to Christianize this idea as well. But I think this concept of, you know, angels, fairies, all sort of being semantics. I mean, it's really, it's having an otherworldly encounter. And it takes us back to the magic of being in these thin places, as they call them here in Ireland, they're the Vale or the Margin. I tend to find them referred to as thin places here in Scotland. But these Celtic nations have this incredible association with being able to come into contact with other beings, other dimensions, other worldly environments. And I think now more than ever in the 21st century, reclaiming that and taking a look at what that actually means is really fascinating. And it was one of the things that I'm excited to continue to explore in this series of legends from around the world.
Well, and as always, there's, I think, one exception. And in this case, the exception is the priest from Aberfoyle, Robert Kirk, who basically is the one who doesn't seem to be able to get the mail which his superior sent him, because he mapped all the local legends about a place pretty much behind his church called Doon Hill. And it is also said that he didn't die, that he, close to death, was taken by the fairies to the other world to continue to live there. He has a grave, but it's said that there's nobody in the grave. But when you go to Doon Hill, you see to this very day that there is one specific tree, one specific patch on top of that small hill, where people will leave wishes, where people will leave gifts to the fairies. And, you know, that is quite remarkable, because the Scottish people don't have this kind of attitude towards church in France or in Spain or in Italy, where there's a very devout Catholic community. You will see the burning of the candles and asking the Virgin Mary to intercede for this or Jesus to do this or whatever saint you have a specific liking to. But that is not something, which is within the kind of Protestant mindset. But specifically in Scotland, you wouldn't see people go to the churches to ask for a certain intercession. They specifically seem to head more towards the sacred places of before, where the legends of miraculous healings have been reported. And I think it's fair to say that there are no Christian, well, there are probably a few, but that there's hardly any Christian sites in Scotland which are connected with mysterious healings. They are all more based within the Celtic mythology and the places to do with Celtic mythology and Celtic lore, and specifically with the fairies. But also, and you play with this in the book, the fairies are able to control the elements. And as I said, definitely in Iona they got us off, but also when we were beginning to explore parts of the story of Tamlin, we encountered very freakish weather on a number of occasions. Now, the tradition in Scotland is that it says, like, they tell the tourists, don't like this weather, wait 10 minutes and it'll be a different season. And that is definitely true. But I also spend an awful lot of time here. And I kind of know that it is within certain boundaries. And the boundaries definitely, when we explored some of the sites the first time around, were extremely freakish. And it just was almost like, and I remember a gigantic hailstorm which lasted very few minutes, but it was at a place where we were looking at because it was sometimes mentioned as the Miles Cross Bridge. And even though we had our suspicions about it basically being too far from the action, we still felt we had to explore it. And it's almost as if the fairy world kind of goes like, yeah, interesting, not worth your time, move on. This isn't kind of the setting. And then the places where we were, a few minutes, a few hours later, exploring other settings like the Carterhaugh Forest and places where the main character, female character, would have lived. The weather was lovely, and also the elements just contributed to making wonderful photographs. So all of a sudden, there was very much this devising world almost of kind of going, yeah, not worth your effort. We'll really underline that you're on the wrong path here. But as soon as we were in the right setting, all the elements changed for the better.
It's true. There's a place called the Ettrick Bridge and a place called Akewood or Oakwood Tower, which are often cited as possible locations for this. That Oakwood Tower could have been the location of Janet's house, and the Ettrick Bridge could be where Miles Cross was. And even though we had had mapped all this out, and we could see that they were 7 miles away from Carterhaugh, and it was too far, we were doing our due diligence. Due diligence says you have to investigate everything, and then draw your conclusions. You can't just investigate that which works for you. You have to look at all sides. But it was so funny that day because as soon as we got out to Ettrick Bridge, it not only started, it wasn't just rain, it was hail and it was snow and it was this crazy weather. I mean, we couldn't stay. It drove us out of there. But we drove 7 miles to Carterhaugh, and the sun came out, and it was beautiful. And this didn't just happen once; this happened over and over again. And it was really fun, actually. But it was very interesting because we really did feel like, the forces of nature were working with us. We're saying, if the weather turned really bad, it always turned out to be a place that didn't work, that for we could rule out. Let me emphasize that we didn't rule it out because of the weather. We were able to rule it out for other reasons. But when we went back and looked at it, every place that we had terrible weather, something that really drove us out was something that ultimately we had to sort of check off as not being valid. And the places that turned out to be the authentic locations, like I said, the sun came out and the birds sang, and it was truly, truly wonderful. There's been so many great explorations that we've had in Scotland, and I've really fallen in love with it and reclaimed that piece of my heritage because it's we've you know I grew up in a very strong Irish family. My grandmother used to always say that we had island people from Scotland in our heritage, but I didn't know that much about it and never sort of got too deeply into it until last year. My sister-in-law, the mother of my oldest niece and nephew, is very into genealogy, and she decided as a gift to her kids, she was going to do in-depth genealogical research of our family. And she's been working on that for a couple of years, and it's been fascinating for me because I reap the benefits of it for my own family tree. And we've discovered these connections to Scotland, not to the borders, but back to the Mull and Iona area. And it's a fascinating part of the world. And like you said, every piece of it is, covered with some kind of fairy territory, but also mystical territory. And I wanted to bring this up because I have a new blog out that goes along with this whole concept. And the blog is called Legends of the Divine Feminine, and it can be found at legendsofthedivinefeminine.com. And the first blog is about the island of Mull, but specifically about this very famous, very beautiful Mary Magdalene window. And you may have seen the window and not know that the window is from the island of Mull. And it's a window that depicts Jesus and Mary Magdalene standing together. He is holding her hand in a very unusual way. This is a very couples kind of depiction. It's absolutely stunning. It's a sort of gorgeous blue running through it that you'll see, you know, and you'll see this window a lot. When you look at it, you'll probably say, if you have any kind of interest in the Magdalene at all, you'll say, I've seen this window. But for many, many years, I've wanted to go there and see it for myself and see what was happening with this window. And it is truly spectacular. It's very, very fascinating. And it is the subject of my blog this week at Legends of the Divine Feminine. So if you want to read more about the island of Mull and the magic that happens there, and in this case, how the Magdalene traditions have also been kept in that part of Scotland, it's up there on legendsofthedivinefeminine.com.
Now, when you're looking at the fairy traditions, and this is also very prevalent in Thomas Dreimer legends, but specifically I feel in Tamlin, you're confronted with stories about how Earth people go to this weird realm, a fairy abduction. It's actually a term which is being used, like they are abducted by this otherworldly intelligence. And then also this notion that there can be hybrid beings, that certain children who are born might be part fairy, or that sometimes they were substituted by the fairies in their crib. When you read those kind of stories, specifically in my mind, I kind of like go like, what is the difference between these stories and what we heard about UFO abduction, specifically in America? Whereby in America, specifically through the work of Bud Hopkins, they were very much of like, aliens are here, they are changing our DNA, they are creating hybrid beings, and he made it a very science fiction-y kind of ET real setting, everything happening on this plane. Yet these stories themselves were far more interesting and far more, when I say nebulous, I mean it very much in a fairy sense of the world. For example, there were people who said like, well, yes, we did go on this kind of otherworldly quest. But for example, some of them saw their physical body lying on the couch. They realized it wasn't a physical abduction. And then, of course, John Mack looked at these things. And John wanted to say in his book Abduction that he felt that in his opinion these people were talking about genuine encounters, that what the trauma which these people had gone through was real to them, that they weren't making it up, that they were reacting to these things because in their minds it had been real. They weren't attention seekers. This was something which was real. And for that he wrote Abduction, and then of course he tragically died in an automobile accident some years later. But I spoke to some of the people in his book. I knew some of the people who had contributed, who were the characters in his book. And it wasn't the criticism of John as such, but basically they said, you know, John had to focus on certain aspects of their story to come to the conclusion he was drawing as a Harvard professor of psychiatry. But they again would say there are so many more layers to this. And one of the characters, and I think in the book he's called Carlos, was a very interesting artist, and he basically said that his artwork had changed because of these encounters. He was a okay-ish artist, but he didn't have inspiration, and that his encounters with these creatures, the events which were happening to him, really transformed him and made him into a really stunning artist. He really knew what he wanted to do, and he also felt he developed his technique more. And in short, all of these people came away pretty much saying that what was going on with these encounters, with these alien abductions, was some form of initiation. That they really came into, not necessarily a symbiosis, I think in some examples that is the case, but definitely that these encounters had brought out something better in them, specifically that it opened up their eyes. And the one parallel across the board was that all of these people came away with two things. One, That there was more out there than they had previously accepted. But also an awful lot of them came out with a sense of ecology. The fact that the planet had to be cared for, and sometimes it would be dramatic. Sometimes they would kind of go, "Oh, the world is going to end. We see this happening. The world is going to end unless we do something," which is a very dramatic thing. And then, not necessarily Bud Hopkins, but definitely other people there did the fearmongering, did the scaremongering, like the aliens are here because the world is going to end, and they're creating a hybrid race which is going to reseed the Earth after the apocalypse. All of these things, but the sense of ecology, the sense of there is a bigger world out there, is again the themes which we see within the fairy stories, the sense that we need to care for the Earth, because if we don't do it, we're destroying the Earth and we're destroying non-human intelligences with whom we have had a rapport for hundreds, if not thousands, if not longer, years. And that is something which you see both in fairy mythology and UFO abduction mythology. And then, of course, the question is, have we simply misunderstood what this UFO abduction phenomenon is all about? Is it something which we have pushed into new clothing, but actually isn't new at all?
Well, and this is also true of the angel encounters, right? We personally have a number of friends who have had angelic encounters, which have then cause them to turn around, change their lives, but also become phenomenal artists. Two of who are extraordinary painters who had never painted before, one who's an exceptional musician who had never been a musician before. So they have these encounters with an angelic being or an otherworldly being or a supernatural encounter, whatever that is. And when it is over, they're able to do something they couldn't do before or that they didn't know they could do before. Also similar near-death experiences. People who come back after having a near-death experience, they have a communication with someone or something on the other side. They come back here, they become phenomenally psychic or artistically talented. So I think that it takes a number of different forms, but maybe we are talking about all the same thing. I think it's an amazing concept. One of the things I wanted to say about this whole idea of abduction is some of this is also open to interpretation. You know, when you look at all the interpretations of Tamlin, and I truly think that I've read everything that's out there over the years. I've certainly made it my quest to read everything that's out there. And you see over and over again this idea that the fairy queen abducted Tamlin and takes him into the underworld. But when I started analyzing the ballads, the original versions, the oldest versions, and I take this apart, and I do this at the back of the book if you want to see this in detail. It is in there, this analysis. But nowhere in any of the original versions of the ballad does it ever say that Tamlin is abducted. It does not say that Tamlin is abducted. It says that he goes with the fairy queen. It says the fairy queen caught me when from my horse I fell. And the interpretation is I caught him, as in gotcha. I'm abducting him. But you can also look at it, I fell and she caught me. You know, there is this kind of maternal, the fairy queen saved me when I fell from my horse and carries me to the underworld to take care of me. So it's the same thing. You know, Thomas the Rhymer is not abducted. You know, Tamlin is, I do not believe, abducted. In the Irish stories, the stories of Niamh and Oisin, he is not abducted. He goes with her very, very willingly. So more often than not, I think if we analyze some of these ancient tales, we see that these characters are not abducted at all. They do go willingly into this initiation. And so, I mean, I don't know how applicable that is to people who are having these UFO experiences, because in some cases I think they are traumatic. But I think in the cases of the fairy kingdom, I actually don't think that any of these people necessarily go into this initiation process, whatever it is, unwillingly. I think that there is some kind of tacit agreement that they're going to do this.
But I also think, and this is, you know, to some extent, I think the nature of the beast, that to be initiated, you have to be sort of shaken out of your body a bit. And we see aspects of that in the Ballad of Tamlin when Janet tries to reclaim Tamlin to human form. The extent of the initiations in ancient times also suggests that, you know, people were taken out of their daily routines to kind of like really kind of like literally be shaken up to kind of like experience these things. And I think being shaken up is for an awful lot of people what is required to kind of like awaken to this other world reality. And I think what I'm kind of like seeing is that it depends on where you are. Kind of like, definitely in the fairy realm, if you fall off a horse, it doesn't necessarily mean the fairy queen appears to you. But if it were to happen in a certain place, then it might happen to you because you are in this land where the land has guardians, where there are caretakers who will make sure that you are cared for when you fall off a horse, that people will not lead you dying, that people will take care of you, and in the absence of human saviors, that there will be the other world who will save you. But it might also mean that they have to take you to their realm to do these things, and then kind of like you really have a period of missing time, and that is again something, one of the things which Bernd Hopkins identified was this period of missing time as the cornerstone of UFO abductions, and definitely that is something which we see so much in the fairy tales as well. The 7 years is probably kind of like more of an indication, I think, that it underlines that time in this other world is different from ours, and that people, had a missing time experience. For Thomas or for Tamlin, they might be gone for what to them appears a few seconds, but years, if not decades, have passed on this earth. And again, that's that correspondence there between the anomalous experiences of the so-called UFO abduction scenarios and the fairy tale scenarios.
Well, I do like what you're saying a lot about how we have to be shaken in order to have an experience that is going to be transformational. And I think that what we see in these stories over and over again, and certainly in Tamlin, is how the physical form has to be altered. I mean, Tamlin is altered in the story, and a huge piece of Janet's ordeal is to hold on to him while he changes into all of these hideous beasts in her arms, and to never be fooled by the illusion that he is any of these things, but that he is going through this transformation. So what I love about the thematic that goes through all of these ideas, whether it's the fairies or the angels or aliens, is that we as humans are being shaken out of our physical bodies sometimes to sh be shown that we are something greater, that we have a more expansive ability than we give ourselves credit for. We are trapped sometimes in these cages of flesh, and we forget how grand and how extraordinary we are, and how much we are one with a much larger energy that is the universe. And I think that is what is ultimately exciting, is to look at how all of these themes tie together as the great reminder that we are something much, much greater and much more universal, and we are part of the one.
Absolutely. And with that message, we will tell you a bit about where you can get Kathleen's The Ballad of Tamlin, which is basically everywhere in ebook format. Now, you might say, well, I don't have a Kindle, or I don't have an iPad, or I don't have a Nook, or I don't have this. Basically, you will have some means of technical devices because you're listening to us, and you need to have one, which is whether it's a Mac or a PC. And things like Amazon, Kindle, have applications which will run on Macintoshes or PCs. There's an Amazon Kindle application, for example, if you have an iPhone or an Android phone. So you don't need to have any of these devices specifically to be able to read some of this material. So just look at, if you don't have any of them, basically go to Amazon.com. Click on Kathleen's The Ballad of Tamlin, and pretty much Amazon will guide you through how you can get these things, even if you don't have, for example, a Kindle.
Also, if you go to Amazon.com and you click on The Ballad of Tamlin, you will see a little feature that says "Look inside the book." That will allow you to see the prologue and part of the first chapter, so you can really get a feel of whether or not this is something that you might be interested in reading.
So, we have finished the end of this episode of The Spirit Revolution. Again, you can listen to this in a number of ways. You can go to iTunes. You can go to our website, thespiritrevolution.com. You can also go to Facebook, facebook.com/spiritrevolution. We have made it more episodes of our show available on our own website, so you can listen to more of our older shows there as well with a new interface. So please enjoy yourself all there. We will be back next week with another episode of The Spirit Revolution. But until then, from the both of us,
the truth against the world.